Hi, Carol joined. Is anybody else already on?
Rick Weisner.
Hey, Rick, how are you doing?
Pretty good.
Dana Abernathy.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that.
Dana Abernathy.
Hey, Dana, welcome.
Hi, thank you.
It's Michael Lewis.
Pardon?
It's Mike Lewis.
Hey, Mike. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Yeah, Mike. I think this first call Mike's been on since his 6-month tour of duty in Iraq.
Iraq, yeah.
That's right, yeah. We just got back mid-October.
Who just joined?
Anna.
Hey, Anna, welcome.
Thank you.
I don't like the idea of your guests departing quickly, but at the same time, I'm glad you're on.
I am too. Yeah, I've had several guests cancel this week. I was going to have Jeannie Waldron, but she had to cancel too.
Oh, well.
Yeah.
We're...
Jeannie's always one of my favorite people.
Mm-hmm.
Anna, sorry to hear about your... You really had tough luck this year with horses.
Yeah, I really have. I've lost 5 out of 12, but 3 were, you know, my endurance going in prospects. So,
yeah. I do know if you have you compete mares. Is that correct?
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, that's right. Your Tibbetts horses.
My gray mares are my favorites.
Yeah. Is it a gray mare? I don't know. I know of a very good mare that the owner. Has been transferred to Germany.
Uh-huh.
And she's looking to, you know, sell that to somebody.
Anyhow, why don't you do that offline, Zag, if you don't mind.
If you're interested, I'll send you an email offline about
it. Okay, great.
Thank you. May I ask who else has joined?
It's John here.
Hey, John, welcome.
Meg's here, too.
And Meg's here. Great.
Good. We've got our entree.
I hope everybody is... post-Thanksgiving and sort of looking forward to Christmas as opposed to dreading it. I'm very pleased to welcome John Crandall and Meg Sleeper back from Malaysia. And as two of our most experienced riders, they clearly can share with us a number of different ideas and techniques and experiences. And I think it's a real privilege to have them both here. For those of you who think John almost needs no introduction, he's the AERC Triple Crown winner from a couple of years back and the only person who's ever won Tevis, the AERC National Championship, as well as Old Dominion on the same horse in the same year. And Meg Sleeper is an equine cardiologist. Meg, correct me if I'm wrong, at University of Pennsylvania and has also... been a breeder, competed her own horses, you know, sort of like you take them from foal up through, and she's got the cutest little stallion. Anyhow.
has international
and
has gold medals.
International gold medals and all sorts of other good qualifications on her side.
And Carol and I knew her when she was a 4-H. kid riding, but we won't talk about that.
Much. May I ask who else just joined?
Stephanie.
Pardon?
Stephanie Hendrickson.
Hey, Stephanie. Welcome.
Hey.
And I heard lots of other beeps.
Cindy Nelson.
Hey, Cindy. Welcome.
Thank you.
This is Leanne.
Hey, Leanne. Welcome.
Hey. Hey.
At this stage, I'm just going to turn it over to John and Meg. How we normally do these calls, John's been on them before as a clinician, but it's if you all would give sort of like a thumbnail sketch, say 5 minutes for the sake of argument, and then we'll just open it up to questions and answers, and we'll explore what the APEX full members want to get into, basically, and we have these wonderful resources. I hope we'll all take serious advantage of them. Okay, go for it. John, do you want to start, and then we'll go to Meg?
Lead me off again. Where do I start?
the general gist was, at some level, riding faster responsibly, and
yeah.
What I was mentally thinking is, you know, what I'd like to get into, and this is part of the Q&A almost, conditioning explicitly for different courses and how you best tune, in effect, and then ride.
And, you know, that's been, you know, one of the biggest, I think, that things that's changed in the last 5 or 6 years is, you know, the public sentiment was so hard against, you know, in the Middle East where the speeds were getting really high there for a while. And it was, you know, and it was kind of hard on the horses in those early years for them to all to learn to train harder and faster. And not because it's not possible, but because nobody knew quite what they were doing. And when you are training at higher speeds, the tolerances and the forgiveness for it's not wrong and it's not undoable, but the tolerance for making an error is less forgiving. And so you have to be more precise and more careful about just about everything you're doing in your training program. And if you do it right, as they're beginning to sort of get it more and more often, you see examples of just that kind of horse that we actually the first 3 or 4 horses that we saw race there in Asia. I mean, truthfully, there was no doubt that first horse wasn't the best fitted and best prepared horse there, and could have been probably an hour faster if he'd had to be, and still would have outclassed us all in best condition. I mean, it was pretty astounding. And you know, riding at faster speeds isn't really the problem in itself. It's just learning how to get there without with the level of precision that you really have to be training at to be able to do it safely. Did it make any points to anybody?
I guess for both John and Meg, what do you know when you're, you know, you want to take a horse up to the next level beyond, you know, what a lot of us have taken horses to? What type of mix? What have you put into your training program? How have you changed it?
Off speaker.
Meg, do you want to start there? Or?
I guess I can. I guess for me, well, and just to go back a little bit, I think the speed, I think the biggest thing on the side of the Middle Eastern stables is the number of horses they have, because as soon as you start putting on the conditioning and bumping up the speed, you risk injuries, and the only way to deal with that, I think, both ethically but also for your horse's benefit, is to recognize, you know, there's a little bit of heat in the leg today, I'm giving him some time off. And a lot of us just have never pushed that hard where we really are right on the line like that, and it's hard to do if you've only got 1 or 2 horses.
That's a very good point, Meg. I mean, nobody should be trying. You can't really set your goal at being 99.9% as fit as the horse can be with only 1 horse.
Yeah.
Because occasionally you'll have accidentally made them 101% as fit as they can be, and that's left and can't race.
Yeah. I think that's a hard thing for all of us to deal with. And I think it means that if you are pushing that kind of limit, you really have to be doing the extra bit of homework that a lot of times all of us with our schedules tend to not do, where, you know, are you palpating every tendon, every day, you know, all those things that are really important so that you catch things before they become an issue. So that's one part, just going back a little bit. And I think the question was, I'm sorry, my phone was a little garbled, how we've changed our own program. Is that right?
Yeah. That. I mean, we can take this any which way, but that was part of what I am interested in.
Okay. I think for myself, and I know that John has been working with someone also who's trained by the same person who's like my trainer. I think in the last 5 years I've been doing a lot of, it's dressage, but it's basically just riding correctly. And I school all my horses now before they ever go out on trail. And I am pretty religious about doing some of that at least once a week with every one of my horses. And I think that that, for myself, has made a huge change in their level of actually being emotionally mature. I think they're much more, they can handle things a lot better. I think they're more confident.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, I don't know this for sure. I'd like to believe that it's helping me minimize risk of injury because they're certainly using themselves better. I think the biggest thing I've changed in the last few years, and I think it's very, very painful for me.
That's a point.
So when you're saying schooling, if I'm hearing you right, you're saying you do a lot more schooling before you take them out on trail. Is this my mental image is ring schooling and just kind of general tuning to each other's body language, if you will. At the same time, do you do training of, you know, like obstacles or oddities?
I think there are a lot of different ways to do all these things, and they're probably all great. What I've done, and it's all through a local trainer. She comes and I take lessons as I can. I mean, it's not. I probably do 1 to 3 a month, depending on the month. And she trained with Dominique Barbiera, who is. Also trained somebody in Virginia who I'd met, and I think that John worked with her. And it's actually more just teaching the horse to go balance without a rider on at all. So lunging with one side rein, not two, and just getting them to go round and correctly and balancing themselves. And it's things like shoulder in and that kind of stuff, but you don't even need to do that kind of thing for them to learn how to balance themselves and deal with things. And I've noticed just a huge difference in the horse. You know, when I first started, I pretty much the horse, I could get on it in the ring. It would walk and trot, and I would go out on trail. And again, I thought the ring was boring, and we would just go out, and I thought I was doing things on trail, and that's all we really needed. And I think a lot of endurance people tend to believe that. You know, you see that the advertisements, this horse would make a great endurance prospect, and, you know, it's an insane horse, and it's not used to being rated. And doing the equitation and the things that really, there's a reason why people did that in the beginning when they were using horses for mile after mile, and they needed them. They needed to stay sound and learn how to use themselves correctly. And I think, I mean, for me, it was just, I didn't know any better. I just, you know, we could circle, we could back, we could, you know, do the basics, but it wasn't really truly riding. And so now that's what I get them all going to a point where they don't necessarily have to be cantering, nice little canter in the ring before they're out on trail, but I expect them to gradually develop those things over the first year or two. And as far as obstacles, I don't necessarily do that frequently. For Malaysia, I actually did quite a bit of Cavaletti work because I knew there was probably going to be a lot of water. And, you know, it would be a lot of pulling through deep footing, potentially. So I did a lot of Cavaletti work with her. But I don't routinely do that unless it's specifically for a ride. They might do 1 or 2 days a month of some Cavaletti work, but it's not a regular thing that I do.
And you've got to be, it's important that if you know the course will have specific challenges, you know, like pulling out of mud or running through water, or if it's going to be a flat course and you don't usually go there, it's important to expose the horse to exactly the same conditions, because the way he has to condition his body, particularly his lower limbs and his coordination, are have to be perfectly related to the way he'll be performing in that race. The big problem is that most people make is they underestimate how far back that conditioning, that preparation has to become. And if you try to do all of, say, you know, you're going to a deep sand ride, and you start getting your horse ready for deep sand competition only 2.5 months before the ride, you're probably making your things worse instead of better, because it may take longer than that. And so it's very important not to sort of, are you guys getting all this beeping noise? I'm sorry about that. I'm in a Home Depot doing some shopping, and I could. I'm going to try to get away from them. Anyway, but it's really important to sort of be careful that as you think you're preparing the horse for this, that you're not actually pre-stressing him to something he's about to get. And that he'll have plenty of time to actually respond and then be rested from that. But those were a lot of good points that Meg was making about how important fine equitation really is to when you're trying to speed up. Because the horse not only has to be classically yielding well, and it's really, really important that they are, that they come collected and that they do it softly. Because if you're having to haul on them and hold hard back, you're not getting the same level of softness through his whole body, and he's just not using his whole body well. And it, he usually pays for it on the lower limb, because that's kind of where the metal hits the road if the rest of the body isn't supple. And so the more speed training you're having to do, the more critical it is that you really are able to run roundly and lightly at the same time. And you can't overdo that. I try more and more to keep more of exactly what she was describing integrated into my program. And it's hard for us, because we are trying to balance how much time do you have to give to your schooling work and your dressage work versus how, you know, if you're just doing the fitness work we already do a lot of. And the key is it's got to become almost integrated together. I mean, you'll see me, you know, as I'm doing my training works nowadays, I more and more often notice that actually here and there's a moment where I can stop and do some other drill without it really interrupting the physical workout. And you may see me doing side passes down a piece of road that has nice footing, or stopping and even though it is necessary, doing some bending and backing drills somewhere as we go around a small obstacle. And making a test of it all the time, and it actually makes your exercises much more interesting for you and your horse.
And I just like to add, Meg and John emphasized how important that is, as you asked the, you know, the up the speed on the horse. Be interested in what John and Meg say. I feel it's equally important if you like to do the really tough terrain rides, which is what I like, because the side passes and shoulder ends and all that strengthen a lot of those small muscles that don't get strengthened in just straightforward work that becomes so important when you're doing uneven terrain and side hill terrain and all that.
Yeah. And going back to one thing much earlier, you know, talking about, and that if you are that precise about how you're schooling your horse, well then, yeah, that does push your risk of having an injury in that training program way down, even if you are training with some more speed than you previously had. If your precision has increased as well and your equitation has improved at the same time, your risk won't improve and won't get higher. But there's still going to be some inherent risk that you have to accept, that if I'm doing a program that's aiming towards near optimal fitness, you're not going to do that without having some risk that says, you know what, I may have to just pull the plug here, you know, 8/10 of the way through this thing. And that's why, you know, those big stables do have that advantage. You know, if you've got 10 horses preparing for that race, you actually, it's a big advantage to both you and the horse because they put themselves in a position where they're truly objective. And it doesn't cost them that much to say, oh, this horse gets a rest. So in the end, those horses, I watched them over there, they end up getting fairer decisions made in their behalf, because the trainer's not under that much pressure to stay on the program with him if it looks like he had a bad step and he has to rest out and pick up another race some other day. And it ends up being a lot fairer to the horse. You know, you talked about the Triple Crown that I did, and I've always repeated that Heraldic did all three of those races, but part of what really made it happen for Heraldic was the fact that he had two other good horses backing him up right behind him. And it made me train much more confidently and secure in what I was doing was actually the logical and most appropriate amount of pressure and training program to put on him, because I could trust myself, I could really carefully trust myself to have pulled the plug on him if he'd so much as had a bad step or the slightest little indication that he was getting overstressed anywhere. And yes, he was rubbed down and checked thoroughly every single day, everything I could touch. It takes me sometimes 30 minutes to finish grooming my horses, just because I want to know what everything on that horse should feel like. But it's really important, if you ever can, if you really are intending to really have a horse really highly fitted up for a season, if you can have another one behind you, it makes you a wiser person in the end. You can't expect too much of yourself when it comes to being objective.
Meg and John, how important is the mental part of getting horses ready for this competition, in the sense that one of the things that struck me reading the reports from Malaysia was that, you know, two of our horses took essentially 30 minutes to come down. In fact, I think one of them I read would not have actually recovered had the lightning storm not zapped their timing system and they lost track.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, was that because the horses couldn't deal with the mental stress, or was that actually, you know, the metabolic recoveries, and how do you handle that type of...
No, that was actually, those two horses were the two that were the most neurotic, and they just basically, that was a mental problem. That was a discipline. That was a self-discipline issue on the part of the horses.
Yeah, and I agree. I don't think that was a metabolic issue at all.
It was not metabolic at all. I mean, we kind of almost expected that of those two horses, but it was much worse than what they'd anticipated. But they were, you know, those, both Kathy and Val knew that their horses were going to have a difficult first vet check.
Is there any way to, I mean, ideally what you'd like to do is gallop the horses, you know, with lots of other horses frequently, which most of us don't have the luxury of knowing how to do.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that?
That too, and also it keeps coming back to the same, there's several things that could have happened to have helped those kind of situations. One, some horses do just have a proclivity to have a little bit higher strung mind. And for those, it's really, really important that they get a really good disciplined start before they get so very mature. Because if they grow up, if they grow mature without having had a good, for lack of a better word, a good round 10 day, you know, where they got a knot tied in their tail and learned to find enough metal in themselves to still listen to you and stay clear-headed and when they're under a little pressure. And unfortunately, that can be done later in life, but it takes a tough epiphany for them. to help those horses have that kind of mental steel. And so for once they're mature, like I said, it can be done, but it's awfully hard, you know, later. Like I've seen it, you know, done, but the horses really have these full body sweat epiphanies to get there. And then the other things are that it becomes more and more important that you have, for if you do have a horse like that, and you can't, you know, it's much more important that you've drilled those aids and those cues, and particularly about having the horse respond to a lowering headset and dropping and rounding soft on your hand. It's very important that he has not only drilled them to the point that he knows it and you can do it, but he's drilled them so much that it's become his reflex and not something that he has to think about. Because only if you get it schooled to the point where the horse kind of reflexes you, gives you that before he thinks about it and then thinks about it later, if you can get to that point, then you may have the ability to literally put the horse in a position where he cannot look at those things that are driving him wild. And you'll see me do that with a couple of mine that are really high strung. I mean, that I'm actually pretty militant with them about their head position and where they're allowed to look. Because you can't afford to let them have free rein of where their eyes are focusing, or they'll just snowball their anxieties. And so it really helps you if you've really been if you've really got a good handle on getting them on this a reflexive reaction to your hands to drop down and follow your signal for a head position, because then you actually have a chance to sort of control their anxiety level. They don't do it for themselves, unfortunately. Horses never know to just don't look at that. You know,
they want to get out of Dodge.
They want, yeah, and their natural reaction is to throw their head up and get, particularly Arabs. Like I've always said, Arabs are the worst because Arabs are so much more optically focused. Optically, their brain is so much more optically input, you know, oriented, that they want to get their head up and they want to get their eyes out there so they see all that. And part of what good training and part of what it means to be trusting the rider to do his part is to accept the fact that when you say put your head down and drop into my hands, it also at the same time you're rounding them up, you're actually also controlling what they're seeing and what they're looking at. And you can actually sort of have a half a chance to control their anxiety problem and cut it, nip it off in the bud.
Can you do that in the vet check too, so they get their heads down and relax?
Absolutely, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's all about if it's done right, it takes less pressure and less action, and the rest of the world doesn't even know the kind of conversation you and your horse are having. Mm. You know, it can be done so subtle that to an untrained eye, nobody even knows that. There's a 10 signal a minute, a signal a second going back and forth between you and your horse, communicating with your fingertips.
So how do you
and you're keeping him, and you're keeping him so busy that telling him just about what's the right spot to set his head that he doesn't have time to think about why he should argue with you. And he just begins to do it because you're not giving him a chance to even think of why he should argue. No. And if you can begin to do that, you can take some of those neurotic, about to explode horses, and if you're quick on the ball about it, you can keep a lid on that problem. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it sure does. I just wish I knew how to do it.
Yeah, you know, I mean, a lot of these, particularly about the hand on the ground manner stuff, a lot of these natural horsemanship guys have got that pretty good. Buck Brenneman, for one, you know, he shows some really nice techniques about how to truly train your horse to be really responsive to the halter. And or and there's several others. He's not the only. I mean, there's plenty of them. And if you can really focus on that, you'll be surprised how really important and useful that can get to be. And it even, if you can get him that same sort of communication pattern, if you can teach it in the halter, you're already two steps ahead teaching it through the bridle. And getting him to really begin to communicate with you. You'll teach your own reflexes through your fingers, the kind of reflex and communication pattern and reflex that you need to have a really good communication channel going faster, learning to do it off the halter than you will in 5 years of bopping around somebody giving you lessons while you're riding. And it'll kind of make a big help for you to finally get that same feeling in your fingertips when you're on his back. Anybody else? Meg, you want to add to that? Or?
Yeah, I was just thinking I feel very thankful I've never had one like this.
Well, you know, I mean, I don't think that I know that I've had a few of them that sort of gave that to me easy, and those were the gifts, and the rest of them, I've had to work at it, and I'm working at it more and more, and I'm getting closer to achieving that more and more consistently all the time, and I don't claim to be as perfect as I can be about it, because like I said, our time always gets divided. I mean, how much can you spend on this versus just getting him fit so he can run? But I'm getting more efficient about how those kind of things stay integrated into my program. And that's helping me get more of that kind of thing done all the time, because I'm gradually learning how to have them more efficiently meshed into what I'm doing all the time. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a lot about training yourself to be just disciplined and doing this as a habit yourself every moment, so that you're not wasting a moment just standing around with your horse, not learning anything with each other.
Meg and I have been talking a lot.
I'm having difficulty hearing.
Yeah.
I might be making some noise for a moment. Let me get. Am I making wind again?
You're making wind.
Just a moment. I'm about out of the wind. You don't get to do anything without double tasking anymore.
Yeah. This goes back a way, some level. The first three horses, say, that Stag and I had in the sport one way or another, we sort of backed our way into things. And more recently, we've been more directly exposed to the control that you can establish with a horse in a halter. And I'm going to throw this one at Meg. I know you started also Chaucer and then have progressed into your own breeding and things like that. Are you finding it easier the younger you start with a horse? Getting the relationship, the control, the ability to, you know, set the head, or is this something that's becoming more important as you've gotten into it more and therefore has been added to the program or whatever? I'm trying to figure, okay, how much of a rehab issue do I have here?
I started I have to give Val Canavy credit because she is the one who got me started with it. When we were in the first time we went to Dubai, and I guess it was like 2002, so it's pretty recent that I started doing this. She said, you know, there's this great trainer in Virginia named Linda. Oh my gosh, something in my mind. I can't think of her last name, but
Bartinger?
yes, Fortuner, thank
you. That's the one.
I'm assuming you work with her some, John, because you're...
Yeah, I send her horses whenever I've got a spell they can go to her.
I was going to say, I noticed some of the similar things that you and I do. But anyway, I think you should send her there for a month. So we did. We came back and we did. And it was really wonderful, and it was great. Troy came back, and there was definitely something there that he knew, but I didn't know it. And Linda tried to teach me, but she was in Virginia. So it was pretty hard to... I went down for one lesson. I mean, it didn't work. So just by chance, I found a person local who trained with the same person that trained Linda. So the same kind of background, and it's more of a French style. It's very light. There's no, because I tried to find some dressage people because it seemed to me like this was something I needed to do, but it was very rigid, and you kind of forced the head into a frame, and I hated it. And Linda and this other person local to me, Nancy, it's very much just how you ride, and the horse goes into a frame because your balance is better. So basically, I guess what I'm saying is Troy was a rehab. he started out, I mean, it's amazing I didn't break him, really. I mean, he just, went along and did his thing, and he's been hard because he doesn't see why he has to do this stuff now. He'll do it, but he started, at 10, I guess. It's been a lot harder with him, and it takes a lot more patience from me and from him, too, I'm sure. But he's come a long way. I mean, he can do a great shoulder in, he can do haunches in, he can do all those things. It's just been a lot harder. The youngsters, and then all of mine since him, have started at some point in the middle. So some of them might have maybe started after they were going on trail, but they didn't do this first. And I have to say the ones now that are 5 and 6 started doing this from the beginning, and it was much, much easier. I mean, they just figured it out easier, and it just seems like the communication is much, much easier. But I think they can benefit from it any time that they start it. And I think I was thinking of this when John was talking about the communication and getting them to relax. This has nothing to do with being in the vet gate, but at the start, I noticed in my own, one of the things that I have struggled with is that tendency to, when things get a little bit crazy, to tense up and to kind of grip. And I'm certainly not perfect, but I've gotten a lot better. And I've noticed that really helps my horses at the start and just along the way. If something scares them, I usually can kind of go back into that, all right, breathe deep, sit deep, don't grab, just stay balanced and try to stay there, and hopefully they won't shoot out from under you. if you don't grip, there's a lot less of a response from them. It's been really interesting. So I think that kind of time really goes a long way for a lot of different reasons, not just to protect them going over uneven footing or up and down hills, to get them on their butt so they are pounding their forehand. But it also just really helps them focus on you and stay sort of relaxed when you need them to stay relaxed.
Horses are, their anxiety is quieted when they have a communication channel that's working, because then that satisfies their brain's need for input, and they get to be content with whatever doing. They don't have egos that so much. At least most of them don't. So terrible. And they're really, most often, if they're in an anxious situation, if they've got other input and another communication that's working, it helps them shut out things that they shouldn't be getting worried about. And so, yeah, you have a huge ability to control your horse's anxiety level, which has all sorts of wonderful metabolic, effects.
I don't know if that answered was kind of what you're asking, Cheryl, but that's my 2 cents of what you, I thought you were asking anyway.
Yeah.
You know, anytime a horse learns something important like that late, the problem is that they tend to learn it pretty, they can, after, first they have a trouble learning it at first because they've got to sort of unlearn things. And then once they have got it, they've sort of got it there in the short-term memory, but what happens is as soon as they are not, as soon as they're out of practice for a while, you're out of regular riding, you've turned them out for a while, it real quickly all becomes equally long-term memory with the things that they knew before. And so it isn't on the top of their brain, you know, it isn't at the top of their priorities, it isn't at the top of their learning anymore. And so the older ones that have this other way of thinking that they had to unlearn, if they're not kept consistently working at it, if you put them out for a holiday for a while, you're going to have to be prepared for having to do a more of a refresher course to get those back into it every time, because their memories of what was before they learned any of this come back to the surface. Does that make sense? You're competing with old
experience.
History. Yeah, and you're competing with it after you've gone out to history. Well, then both the new thing and the old thing are still a fairly old knowledge at that point. And the old thing, the original old thing, begins to outweigh, you know, and come back to the surface. And so those horses just need, you'll just have to commit a little more time to check things through. Every time when they're brought back out from a rest spell in particular.
Yeah, I'm smiling because I think of my first horse who was first trained to be a racetrack thoroughbred tattooed mare. And then my current horse who, you know, what Meg is John are saying, you start out doing all the equitation training. I'm just thinking about the difference of the first two rides on those two horses, even though, you know, both had equitation training. You're so right. And also, I think Meg made a great point. I'd be interested in John's view, too, that our Arabs need sort of the French light type of training, not the sort of Germanic push-pull type training.
You remember that thing I did when some of you were in the class last time, you know, when I was flexing and bending that lunge whip, that riding whip between my hands, and how erratic that got when you did the same flexing and bending, it sort of had a nice harmonic and it wiggled all around easily. And if you just put a little bit of compressive pressure on the same time, and then asked it to do the same flexing and bending, all of a sudden the behavior became stiff and erratic of that stick. And the same thing is happening inside your horse's spine. And our horses are, you know, real easily disturbed by that. So you never really have your horse perfectly round and perfectly using his whole body if he's doing it with against much pressure. He has to learn to find it and to appreciate finding it very lightly. And he always has to have somewhere to go to bend to freely. And that's why, you know, I try to stay away from using both side reins. Because you want it takes twice, it may take longer to get the horse to come around. It may take me more days to actually get a very significant bend to come from him, but with it being completely from his nose to his tail. But when you achieve it that way, you get a much more perfect and a much more supple bend. Does that make sense? Have I lost everybody?
No, I think you're okay. Let me at least go around the people I know who are on the call. Rick, do you have any questions at this stage?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Dana?
No.
Any place that you'd like to have the conversation go?
I'm, you know, this is my first call, so I'm just kind of following along. Absorbing.
Okay. Mike Lewis.
Yeah, same here. It's my first call in a while, so I'm just listening in and trying to follow.
And Anna?
Well, my question is, you know, this all makes a lot of sense to me, and it's stuff I've done some in my past. But since I live in the middle of nowhere, I'm trying to figure out how I could find somebody to work with to give me this training again, because I do see how important it is, and I feel a bit of a disadvantage, not that I wouldn't haul for, you know, a number of miles for lessons, a few hours, but you guys have found great people to work with, and what, any advice on what to do about that?
Are there any of, you know, my writing instructor, John's, Meg's, do any of these people, pardon me, are there any ways of doing this in some senses remotely?
I don't.
You know, I think it could be more now with the right material, but I don't know where it exists.
Yeah, I wonder if some of, you know, it actually would be a nice thing that you could do as Apex. But they would, these people would be great clinicians. And maybe not, and I realize that may not be close for everybody anyway, but I think half of it is spreading the word that, you know, how much some of these people can help. And a lot of it is groundwork, which could be done, you know, in a clinic situation without necessarily even people bringing the horse. Although, obviously, that would be really wonderful if people could actually get lessons. But that might be useful. And there must be some kind of network for these instructors, because I had a hard time finding somebody. It took me quite a while, and I tried a few people. And you know, even people that are very, very good and train horses very well and, you know, are soft and all the things that you want them to be, they can't necessarily teach.
Mm-hmm.
Or at least they couldn't communicate to me because, you know, I was so remedial. I had no idea what they were even telling me to do.
Mm-hmm.
So, which, gets, you know, just gets frustrating, and the horse gets frustrated, and you quit. So there must be some kind of network out there for people that are good instructors for, I mean,
would you lean more toward like a natural horsemanship or a dressage trainer or a kind of what avenue do we need to be looking for, do you think?
I think, you know, the reality is it kind of depends on what you already have and where your missing pieces are. You know, that's the way it's been for me because, honestly, I haven't had any great opportunity to train exactly with Linda Bertzinger or with this person or with that person, you know, until I, quote, got it from them. And the truth is, from my observation of how different people learned, almost nobody really gets it from one person.
Right.
There are a certain few eggs that you might be able to take from one person and a certain few eggs you might take from another, from that natural horsemanship guy, and a certain few eggs you might take from one another person. And then one day, somebody you won't even think could ever teach you anything will hand you that one last egg and you'll complete your dozen. And that's kind of the way it works. And the other thing is, you know, you have to just not be afraid that each time one of these people, you feel like you've been inspired and you've learned something from one of these guys, you know, from somebody, is to go back and tinker with it and take your time, you know, and not expect to, you're much more likely to be able to replicate what you want and what you saw from this person with your horse if you just relax and try to do it in five times as much time. and give yourself a chance to do it casually. And if it doesn't seem to be working, just slow down even more until you and your horse are kind of, until you're feeling a communication happen again. And you get, and that's the key, is that, that you do it without ever really losing a sense of, I'm doing this and he's responding, so I'm doing that and he's responding, so that you're reacting to each other, you know.
Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Oh, God.
Oh, that's Cindy. Yeah, I think Cindy and Leanne are on. Not sure who else we missed.
Stephanie.
Stephanie.
Yes, I'm here. It's very helpful, and I have three horses I'm working with, one a 15-year-old who's just hot and miserable. My first horse, which made me realize that things needed to be done differently. So when I picked up a horse as a yearling, I got to tell you, the best thing I think I ever did for that yearling was I started taking him to local horse shows where there was chaos and kids and horses running everywhere, and putting him in halter classes that he had no hope of ever even doing anything. But people were looking at him, and he had to trot out, and they would touch him. And he was among chaos. And then when I started riding him, 3-4 years down the road, I would still take him to those horse shows and ride him in the warm-up arenas where everybody's going crazy and walking horses are going in and saddlebreds who are just crazy by nature. And I tell you, he is, I mean, when he walks into an endurance ride, he's got his head down and he's just, you wouldn't think he was an Arab. And he is the steadiest, most sensible Arab I have ever come across. And I'm really pleased with how he's developed them. But 7.5 years into it, I mean, it's taken this long to get him where I think he's ready to now actually be competitive.
Having a little bit of that kind of backgrounding would have sure been important for some of those horses in Malaysia at the start.
The what?
In Malaysia. That was the wildest endurance rodeo I've ever seen.
we saw it on
the
video.
Mostly the American
right.
horses that were being rodeos. But,
yeah, and unfortunately ours were right in there. That's right. Unfortunately ours were right in there. Yeah.
I totally agree with what you're saying about the horse showing. I don't really
I don't show either. I would just take him to the horse shows that were local just to expose him to the chaos.
Yeah, well, I think it's just exposing them to all those things. I use a lot of competitive trail rides for the exact same thing. They learn to be out there with other horses. People are doing their own thing. They focus on you. They go at the rate you tell them to go. I think that, you know, riding in any environment where they have to listen to you is really important. And I don't usually start, I don't do an endurance ride with any of my horses until they're 6 or 7. They're doing competitive when they're 5 and 6, and I've never changed that. Because I think that is important for them to develop that way. And I use hunter paces and those kinds of things. I would consider going to a horse show, but I'd be embarrassed, I think, with how I dress.
I don't have to braid my horse's manes.
But any of those things, you know, they're great to. I mean, I think it's very unrealistic to expect that any horse, no matter how old they are, if they've never been in an environment with other horses that they don't know, that are all doing their own thing, that you're going to take this horse to an endurance ride and not have, I mean, hopefully not faster, but I think it's pretty likely that things could be a little rough. And if you don't put that homework in, it's hard to get anything better.
Yeah, and you mentioned hunter paces. Those, where if you don't have competitive trail rides, those are great for young horses.
Yeah.
You know, if you think about some of the heritage of wild horses, you know, we hear so much talk all the time about their natural fright responses, you know, to predator attacks and such as that. But, you know, the more I've watched wild horses myself and think about it, the more I realize that the predator role really didn't play that much in their evolution or change their psyche that much. Because, like most herd animals, the predator really only picked up the ones that were failing at the back of the herd for some other reason anyway. And so evolution was correcting that reason. You know, if they couldn't move well enough to forage well and were getting low on calories and poorly, they died. And it wasn't because of the predator. It was because they weren't foraging well enough. And so likewise, when we think about flighters, you know, what was a wild horse really most afraid of, and what did they really need to get their brain programmed to react to? It wasn't to jump away from a cougar, because he wasn't going to be in that position unless he was a weak horse in the back of the herd anyway. The one thing that every horse had to have his brain wired, pre-wired to be ready to be watching out for, and the most likely thing to attack him his entire life was another horse. And so horses, it's very natural for them to be, you know, to be extremely paranoid and anxious when they get among strange horses. And yeah, that's why, you know, because strange horses attack you. They, you know, I mean, and they attack you lethally. You know, more horses in the wild get maimed by other horses than anything else.
That I never thought about. That's a cool observation, because, like, even the horse, you know, we've noticed that if we've got three of our own horses riding with a strange horse, boy, we have to be careful, because one of our horses will try to nail that strange horse in a moment.
Yeah. I mean, horses are ruthlessly competitive with each other. That's just the nature of horses. And so when he's surrounded by a sea of strangers and his herd mates are few and far between, that's an understandably extremely anxious environment for any horse. And it does take some preconditioning for a lot of them to get over that, particularly if they're not inherently very dominant. Even the inherently dominant ones are going to get riled up because they're looking for somebody to have to kick.
Yeah, my most dominant horse is the one I do not want to take on an endurance ride. He's miserable because he thinks he needs to dominate and run the herd of every other horse there. I mean, it's a miserable day when I have to take him.
Right.
I would much rather take the horse that's low on the totem pole than to take the dominant horse.
Cindy, I don't think we've heard from you.
What's that?
Do you have any questions?
I do want to ask about Malaysia, the lameness issues. What was going on with that? Was it the ground? I mean, I kind of wondered if we were going to Malaysia and running on really hard-packed ground after training in Florida, where we had all of that rain and the ground probably was a little softer than we needed. Was it related to that in any way?
You mean
our horses in particular that got pulled for the lameness?
Well, the lameness.
For what the lamenesses were, it was never specified, really.
Yeah, I don't know. There were a lot of lower end ankle issues, I think, through the entire field. It ended up being the big thing for everybody. Truth is, I think it was just really a symptom of overtraining. There was a lot of horses through all the barns that were only sound enough to get trotted out good, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Mine included, it turned out, you know. And I think really it was just an overtraining issue. I think a
few
of them.
Did you have reservations about that
when
you were in Florida preparing for this? Did you have reservations about the way the training was being handled at that point?
No, not so much in Florida.
Uh-huh.
For one thing, my horse got almost one rest more missed a workout because I was
too
busy.
Oh, that's right. You were sick.
Trying to save my calf from MRSA. Yeah.
That's right.
So if anything, he actually ended up skipping a workout less than what I had planned for him. But somehow, somewhere, you know, something got stressed. And the truth is, I knew I had a little issue when we touched down right when we touched down in Malaysia, but we weren't allowed to rest the horses then. So, who knows?
Yeah, I think.
In fairness to Meg and Jan, I don't know if you knew Stephanie, that they're two a bolt of. Well, Meg, why don't you tell the story of what happened?
That was the lightning strike.
What I was going to say, it's easy to kind of want to blame something, and I don't, you know, obviously you never know for sure, but our two horses collided when the lightning struck right next to me, actually. And they went off in the jungle and fell and rolled, and, you know, it was pretty bad. And they seemed fine afterwards, but it was for both of them, the leg that they collided in and then rolled, that they were lame in later on the day. So, you know, it's hard to ever know for sure what caused it, but I think it was a factor. They both went down really pretty hard, and actually Jan was really quite hurt.
Your two might have been the two exceptions to what I was just saying, but that was what I noticed about the field in general among the other horses.
I think the footing, there were puddles that would have been nice not to have to go through, but, I mean, the footing was really quite nice. It was beautiful.
Yeah. You really couldn't fault the footing that much.
Yeah, and I think that as far as the conditioning and the things that we were doing in Florida, I mean, pretty much we were all doing, I think, what we wanted to do. It wasn't like there were mandates as far as what we were supposed to do.
Actually, there were mandates, but we all did what we wanted.
We pretty much did what we wanted to do.
And that was my question. Is the United States moving toward having basically someone dictate the training of the U.S. team horses? Is that where we're headed?
I think there was an overall goal and sort of a picture, but it wasn't specific. At least this is my impression, John. You tell me, you know, what you thought, certainly. But it wasn't like today you're going to gallop 18 miles and tomorrow you're going to walk 6. It was more, I'd like you to do 1 to 2 strong conditioning rides a week, and otherwise I'd like the horses to be at least walking every day. You know, because they were in fairly small paddocks while we were down in Florida compared to what they would have been in the home, where they're moving around a lot more. And I was very comfortable with what they were asking us to do, and it's what I would have been doing anyway in reality.
Yeah.
So I don't know if John agrees, but that would be my assessment.
Yeah, I think, though, that the trend is, you know, at least that was the new plan, was for Yusef to have a strong chef to keep, you know, that would control all of that. Unfortunately, I think that it's ultimately a path that won't work for us if we don't, because it's trying to emulate, you know, the French method of having a very strong managing chef to keep and veterinarian. But that's done in a context where they have a multi-million-dollar budget that's securing those horses 2 years in advance or more, and sponsoring and paying for the horse's development. And the chef keep and those team managers have known those horses for years, not a month or a few weeks.
Right.
And to come in at the last minute and have this super powerful micromanager is a bizarre situation, honestly, where, you know, if your horse is lame and you're insisted that they go out and ride him anyway, you know, because they have some other paranoia that you have to deal with. I wasn't very happy with it, and honestly, I probably will not go on the team again, particularly as long as we have to sign that waiver, because it's absurd. I don't want to have to be worrying about somebody suing me after the race for breach of contract because I'm trying to save my own horse. So I doubt that I will be on the team again. I can't, for one thing, I can't afford that kind of risk, you know, on my horses.
Well, you know, I think all of us who are coming into wanting to do the FEI rides and to do that level of riding and training are kind of getting this feeling. I mean, I have no problems with the qualifying of the novice rides and qualifying up. I really don't have a problem with that, other than the fact that I think the United States basically, in effect, got caught with its pants down. I honestly believe that we should have, we been thinking and been smart, known that when the UAE president's wife was put in as head of the FEI, that something like this was going to come to take the home field advantage off the 2010 World Games. And I think we got caught with our pants down. So now we're imposing all the – I think that what's going to happen is you're going to see people running their horses into the ground to try to get to these levels, and I'm not real happy with that at all. With the new rules, you know, the two-year restriction, that's, you know, with Heraldic even being out, probably one of the top horses in the country, I mean, he would have to qualify up again.
Not if I get him back in soon. He'll
before
be,
June, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So he's okay. But yeah, it stops. It really hampers anybody with more than one horse to ride. It makes it darn impossible for you to get two horses qualified in a year.
Well, sure. I mean, there's three rides on the East Coast, and one out is just a 50.
I'd have to have a you know, a $5,000 budget a horse to hardly get them qualified anyway, and then it gets impossible to do more. So it really
we didn't know this was going to happen though. I mean, last year we were talking about these rules. It's been over a year that we've known it was going to happen.
But unfortunately, all the way through at the same time, there was talk that they were going to give us some kind of transition and grandfather. And
that's one of the reasons I kept asking managers to go FEI last year. I mean, we had very few rides that were FEI last year.
Right.
And we have very few rides that are FEI next year.
Well, next year we've got
more
the three in Florida.
Than you ever have had before.
Yeah, it's not bad. We've got the three in Florida, which is not, you know, obviously easy for those of us in the Northeast, but still, there's three at least. And
well, in this time of the year.
You've got Florida, you've got Biltmore, you've got Vermont,
you've got Vermont,
Wisconsin.
Wisconsin's a long time.
Kentucky's just going to be a 75, but they'll have 75. A 50 and a 75, so that'll have you through, that'll allow you to then go to 100.
Well, hopefully I'll get through Gosey and be grandfathered in.
That's the best case scenario.
Well, sure, and, you know, but I'm paying another person to come and ride one of my horses to try to get, you know, both of them through, and I was one of the lucky ones. Thank you, Apex, for telling me to go ahead last year and passport my horses. Otherwise, I would have been stuck without an unpassported horse. I mean,
that's probably the biggest issue, that a lot of these things we knew were happening, but it didn't probably get except through Apex, filtered down to everyone.
I don't even think it got filtered through Apex. I just went ahead and called Vanita and put myself on the rider ranking list, not even planning to do a ride, just so I could get information. And most of the information was being sent out only to the people on the FEI rider ranking list.
That's for real.
Yeah, that's
the dissipation of information from USIF has been absurdly incomplete.
Yeah, that's maybe
as
something.
As an FEI ride manager for next year, and I put my stuff in for FEI for next year in May this year, I have not been on Vanita's emails.
Yeah, I that's a good point. I'm on the USEF, you know, National Advisory Committee, and probably have the horse with, you know, I have a horse that has 2 fourths and a second in the last 3 four-star competitions in the U.S., and I don't get the USEF information because I didn't sign up for the rider ranking list last year. So hey, that's something that we need to do as Apex, is to tell Vanita she needs to figure out how to broaden her distribution list, because the rider ranking list was for people who had a horse at that point in time that they wanted on the list, which I did not.
Do you know if the information is posted anywhere? I've never actually looked.
Right. Well, actually, it's been coming out. I've been getting it as part of the rider ranking list. And I think some of it has gone to Ride Camp, and it's posted on Ride Camp also. On endurance.net, I think there's a little blog at the top about the FEI rule changes and the explanation of the rules.
And I look, there's a posting thing on the USEF site, too, if you go into endurance, but unfortunately it seems to be not complete either place.
Well, it's not complete, and it wasn't posted until December. And if you think about having to take horses, I mean, for this GOSI ride in particular, and the shots that to be able to compete the FEI, they actually have to have the internasal flus and all of that. And there's a 21-day restriction on it. Basically, it wasn't posted until that 21-day restriction was up. There's no way, if you haven't already done the vaccinations, to even do that.
Well, I can say that's the reason that happened is for the same reason that we didn't really jump on the ball and get a lot of rides going and stuff. Because we, like Meg said, we had wind that they were going to make this rule stiffening, you know, sometime that it was coming. And they even posted a draft last summer in, was it July?
June or July, correct.
But at the whole time, there was also a lot of rumor that there was going to be several more meetings, and they were trying to work out what the grandfather clause and what the phase-in would be for, you know, for particular, you know, and we were expecting that we would get some kind of opportunity to not have horses that are qualified because they've done 5, 6 ARC 100s. Already somehow lose that qualification to go into an FEI 100 immediately, you know, that we'd have some transition, you know, ruling, and that didn't happen. And we didn't know that that was completely didn't happen until a couple days before Benita posted that.
Okay. Well, let us take an action item to suggest that USEF needs to work on a broader distribution. Let me, before we lose people, I've got a couple questions for Meg as an equine cardiologist, but before I put my questions in, are there, I know, I'm not sure Cindy's had a chance to ask questions, and I'm not sure who else are there. Cindy, did you have any questions? Or we lost Cindy already?
Meg, this is Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Tom.
Hey.
How are you all?
Good.
Good. How are you doing?
Good. I would be curious to hear from Meg and John as they visit with competitors. Has anybody got any new insight, any new training, conditioning programs people are using, and what did they learn anything new? Is everybody doing the same thing? They just have 600 horses and we only have two? Or
I think that's a lot of it, actually. I think they're doing a lot more walking than I'd realized before, which sounds interesting, but it's true.
Walking under saddle or hand walking?
Really, walking, what do you mean?
They're walking under saddle, but see, they can, you know, they can afford to pay a bunch of Pakistanis to go out and ride.
Right.
Now, when you say walking, is this just sauntering, or is this walking?
This is power walking. This
power
is
walking.
Like marching,
okay.
Walking, yeah. And I know that Val is doing that now, and of course she has an exerciser, and some other people have exercisers.
You know what this is supposed to benefit, or
what I've heard, and I have to say I don't know that this is true or not. I've never looked, but what they say is that the muscles used in power walking are very similar to canter muscles, so it helps develop the strength to be able to maintain that kind of canter without the wear and tear.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I mean, a lot of these people are, you know, the horses are out for 2 to 3 hour walks per day.
Wow.
Also, that's probably actually maybe the biggest difference, and maybe more important than the numbers of horses they have, is that ability to have so much manpower.
Yeah.
On their horses, and so that they can more finely control everything the horse does 7 days a week. Whereas, you know, in my program, it's you know, I've become to realize the way that I've trained my horses, you know, is just an effect of having to do it fairly manpower efficiently. Mm-hmm. So my guys work, you know, at least once a week, you know, maybe twice a week, and they go out to the pasture so they can walk themselves around. And in the environments there, you know, in the Middle East, say, you know, Juma's horses, they're on a program, you know, where they actually, he does the hard workouts, not any more often, maybe less often, just about once a week. The horse goes out and does a really serious endurance exercise. And then the rest of the week, he's just moved to move his muscles because he's in a stall or a small paddock and has is completely limited. So they control exactly how many steps he takes even on a rest day. And he's moved just enough to limber up his muscles and make things, you know, keep things functioning and, you know, and circulate things a little bit as a horse needs to move every day. But they have exact and precise control. So even a rest day is precisely the rest day the trainer was expecting, which is what I don't have when I'm just turned out in the pasture. I have to watch my horses, and I see when they're getting too playful and they're not resting the way I want, and that tells me, well, it's time I might as well give them another ride. But there, you know, they've got the pattern worked out, and even the rest days are very controlled.
Does that, what you're talking about, does that include, like, the winning horse? Because I did get to see her finish live on the Internet, and that was so impressive, that horse.
Yeah,
started out.
That's right. I mean,
did she train that horse the same way, or did she have a lot of extra horses?
Well, that's Juma. That's the one I was just talking about. That's his, that's his new wife. And
I see. I don't know all the connections.
Yeah. And he trains for Sheikh Mohammed. That happened to be one of his personal horses.
Mm-hmm.
Or it was then. And that's similar over in Hassan's stable, and you know, the several other stables that I worked at is their pattern isn't that much different than what I would do, except that they have a much more precise control over the horse's rest off days. He's still taken out and ridden, but he's ridden lightly and he's ridden precisely just the rest day schedule. You know, and he goes back in. As Hassan said, he's turned horses out like I do and watched them, done several horses with GPSs overnight, and he said he was amazed at how much one horse might run 40 kilometers overnight and another one not. And he said he couldn't tolerate not knowing what his horse did when he wanted him to be resting.
Never thought about putting a GPS on my horse at night. I bet I will now.
So that's, you know, the reason those horses, you know, we hear about them being ridden every day. Well, the truth is they're not hard exercised every day. You know, there's a lot of those days that are just there because they've got the body to put on him, and they do. And that's, and they control even what he does on an off day.
And they don't have hunting season.
No. All they have is hot and hotter.
One of the things that I think we all have to wrestle with, you know, if you're trying to compete at that level, you're competing with endurance racing stables, you know, and are we willing to try to do that, or do we want to focus our goals in other areas?
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough question, but something we have to really wrestle with.
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I've always said, is the only way we will be competitive in America is to try and make ourselves operate as if we were a big collective. And it'll be more than just the numbers USEF can corral into the current approach that they're doing.
If there aren't other questions, I've got one for Meg as an equine cardiologist. Are there any other questions that my question, Meg, is, I know you're doing some pretty exciting research now that's not sure directed towards my question, but I'll ask two. One is, what is the relationship between top horses, resting pulse rates, recoveries? You know, what do we understand about that? And the second question is, more generally, are there new insights that are coming out of the cardiology research that, you know, we should know about and can benefit us?
So as far as resting heart rate and recoveries and those kinds of things, the fact is there's not very much scientific evidence at all. I mean, I think everybody anecdotally thinks that a horse with a resting heart rate of 28 or 30 probably better than, or is going to be a better endurance athlete, I should say, than a horse with a resting heart rate of 44 or 40. But no one's actually really looked at that to prove it and to know if that relationship is true. And it's, you know, it's interesting. I've personally had horses, and I know you have, Stag, because we've talked riding, where one horse might have a working heart rate that's 20 beats per minute at any given speed faster than your other horse. It doesn't necessarily mean he's better. Or worse, there's something. I mean, there's certainly something else that's very, very significant, and heart rate just doesn't necessarily correlate that much with how quickly they're going to recover, and that time to pulse down, which is such an important time for all of them. So. Okay, so as far as that first part of the question, does that sort of a little bit answer it?
Yeah.
Not well.
No,
just to say we don't know.
Yeah, I get it's which has been driving me recently, because I'm riding a horse that works at a higher heart rate than any horse I've had. And it's really hard to get used to, but it seems to be him.
But they can, and I don't. I really don't think it makes that much difference, really. And it's funny because you hear all the anecdotal stories about so-and-so's horse's heart was so much bigger than somebody else's. And, you know, that's important. I mean, it's clearly important. We know it's important from thoroughbreds and standardbreds where people actually pay for research to be done. But there's so many other factors, than, particularly in an endurance horse, that are more important, like soundness. I mean, you can keep thoroughbreds sound enough, and hopefully they don't have a catastrophic injury. So their heartbeat, their heart cardiac output is critical, and that'll be a determining factor for a lot of them, how well they do. For our horses, it's important, but it's just a part of the overall picture. So, and the whole heart size issue, a lot of people that are looking aren't necessarily trained to look for pathology. So the heart may be enlarged because it's diseased. And that doesn't necessarily always get evaluated. So that's actually a big issue in equine echocardiography. So having said all that, we don't have enough data yet from the study that we started this past year. I'm hoping the problem was, and I don't know if you are you still on the board?
No, I'm not on the ARC board now.
Okay. Well, it ended up not getting finally approved until when all of the riders were down in Florida. And unfortunately, there were some issues in that the equipment which we had to use was University of Pennsylvania equipment, and they knew I was not around. So when Mary tried to go and pick it up to go and evaluate some horses, they were like, no, it's a $100,000 piece of equipment, and you can't take it. So it ended up really snafuing us for this whole year. We got some horses done before I left the country, but then it just didn't work. So we're hoping to get everybody done next year. Because the problem is they have to be done close enough to when they've competed that it actually is meaningful. So what we're looking at is a technique called heart rate variability, which is actually looking at heart rhythm. So it's been studied the most in humans, and basically a normal, healthy person has some variability to their rhythm. So even though you kind of think of your rhythm as being pretty regular, It's actually not if you put it in the computer and evaluate it. And that irregularity is a good thing. I mean, there's some rhythms, obviously, that are normal, but if it's a sinus rhythm and there's irregularity, that correlates really well with being healthy, not having heart disease. And it's been used to evaluate a lot of other problems, such as actually overconditioning in marathon runners, which is why one of the reasons I'm so interested in it. But even things as simple as just chronic pain, low-level pain, the heart rate variability goes down. So that's one of the things we want to look at in our horses to see, you know, do these horses that don't perform as well have less variability, which would suggest that they may be overconditioned. That's one possibility. And they have chronic pain, or are there other issues? So that's one of the things that we want to look at with heart rate variability. And then we'll also
It's almost counterintuitive. You're saying less heart rate variability is a sign of either pain or overconditioning or something, as opposed to normality.
Yeah, it's actually lack of variability. So the way to think of it is, if you're chronically stressed, you're going to chronically have some level of epinephrine or adrenaline, which is the same chemical, in your body, and it will be slightly elevated because of that chronic stress. And it could be very subtle stress. It can be just having arthritis, actually, has been shown to that level of stress reduces your heart rate variability. So measuring that tells us that, and actually it has been evaluated in one paper in horses looking at trail running stress, and it did correlate with increases in, you know, stress that the horses felt when they were being trailered. So it's been used in horses, just never in performance horses. And one of the other interesting things, which we don't know if it'll work or not, but heart rate variability, there are some things you can evaluate in the computer that assess something called parasympathetic tone, which theoretically should be what is making some horses recover faster than others. They have a faster return of their parasympathetic drive. So if that's the case, then it may be that this will allow, you know, us to identify horses that recover better. The problem is we just don't know that much about it yet. There's so many different nuances to it that it'll, I think, take a while for us to really be able to use it as to its full extent. But the possibilities are really, really exciting.
Okay. Let me follow up with one other question then, because you talked about recovery times. And be interested in both Meg and John's views on this. Our sport currently puts a real premium on recovery, in that determines how soon you get into the hold, and therefore a horse that recovers quickly can obviously gain quite a few minutes on a horse that is slower to recover during, say, a 100-mile ride with 6 holds. Do we know, though, that actually, suppose instead the rule was you've got 8 minutes to recover to whatever the baseline parameter is, and whether you recover in 1 or 8 minutes, it doesn't matter. If you take longer than 8 minutes, then you get penalized, which I can remember rides that were run like that, you know, 20 years ago. Is that fast recovery really signaling, you know, overall fitness of the horse, or is it just something that we selected for because of the way our sport's developed?
Well, my personal feeling is that there are lots of different factors that determine heart rate recovery, and one is fitness. So I think that it does improve as horses get fitter. But it's also an inherited ability. So some families of horses are just better than others. And those horses, under our current rules, do have an advantage. I personally like the advantage because I think I've been fortunate in that most of my horses have recovered quickly. But I also think that it, there is some benefit that, that the horse should in our sport receive for recovering quickly, because that is also a fitness. I mean, there is fitness there too. And I think it's hard to determine how much is just this horse happens to be a freak and recovers within a minute, and how much is that this horse truly is that fit as well.
But is it only indicative of cardiac fitness or overall fitness of the other systems within the horse? I mean,
it's cardiovascular fitness, which is to alert, which is also problematic, because the cardiovascular fitness is the first part
to develop, right?
Conditioning to develop. So horses can certainly recover very quickly, even though their tendons and bone, you know, the rest of them isn't particularly fit, so they could be stressing themselves.
Right, so you can get into the hold and then have some rebound effect where actually the heart rate shoots back up, because then the other systems, the adrenaline has let down and the other systems then are complaining that something's wrong. But they're
that point. Yeah, that's possible, but if they really have elevated adrenaline that's hiding or masking discomfort, I wouldn't think their heart rate would necessarily come way down. I mean, they might have hit 64 or 70, but they really shouldn't come down the way. I mean, really, it's important with whenever you're competing to monitor the heart rate, of course, throughout the whole hold. So,
right,
you know, you want the heart rate to be essentially normal, or at least what's normal for that horse during the hold. And that should be a flag, that if your horse came down to 64, got through, but is staying around 60, you know, that obviously is not a good recovery.
Can you tell me what a heart score measures?
You know what? I honestly can't, because that is something that different people have come up with their own formulas.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a Basie's, Tantrally's horses heart score. And I don't know what their formula is. The vet who works there, his name is Fred Fragan, and he developed it for them. So it's their own little, which I always find funny, because the advertisement will say heart score of whatever, and I have no idea what that means. it's really interesting. I hadn't realized this, but I've started doing, I interpret some echoes for thoroughbreds occasionally, very rarely, but occasionally, kind of as a fitness thing. I don't say as a fitness, but sort of as a, you know, this horse has a, for his age, a heart that is above average or good and is consistent with a graded stakes winner or whatever. I mean, as far as his heart's concerned, he should be able to compete well. Well, there are people out there, and they're not even vets, and they get $800 every time they do this. It blows me away. I mean, I could retire and just do endurance if I really could figure out how to do this. But they will read an echo and say that that horse will be better on the turf or dirt, distance or sprint, just based on heart size, just the actual the dimensions of the ventricle. And it's really impossible to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't even imagine why you'd think you could tell turf or dirt based on how big the heart is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, you know, we all want something that's easy, you know, if we can get a vitamin or whatever. And I think that's what they're playing up to.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, I'm sorry, that was a tangent, but I don't know what the heart score is.
Interesting.
Wow, have we covered turf?
Yeah.
We started in one spot and wound up in several others. And I want to thank Tom Gower for getting us back at least a little bit towards the original thinking. Are there any new programs? Any new insights with respect to hoof care? Shoeings.
Feed,
yes.
I'll give my little 2 cents and then I'll shut up, because I feel like I've just been rambling and taking over, so I apologize. But I think feet are probably the number one issue for our horses as we start picking up speed. And I I think it's really hard to find a good farrier. Stag and Cheryl are lucky they've got a good one, and John certainly does his own, so he's good. But I think that's a huge issue for a lot of our horses, because little imbalances that they can, you know, a show horse can put up with in soft footing, or when you're going slow, they can deal with. It's a big issue when they're going fast. So I think that's a big deal. And as far as feed, I just use, I'll say the product. It's KER, just their Enduro.
Enduro Event.
Thank you, Enduro Eventer. But I think there are lots of good feeds out there. I do like a higher fat, and I actually will add some flax seed, ground flax seed. Now I've started doing that the last year. But,
okay, and I have found that my horse won't eat the 10% grain with additional oil put on top of it. It's like you put oil on top of 10%, you're asking for trouble.
Will he eat flax?
But the ground flaxseed works?
That's why I switched to it. I was using, actually, originally I was using corn oil.
Right.
And then I read that canola oil was a better N6-N3 ratio. You know, constantly trying to rethink it and do it better. I switched to canola. And then, actually, the horse head in Malaysia just does not like oil of any kind in her food. The other guys will all eat it, but she doesn't like it. So,
yeah.
I tried flax, and she will eat flax, and I can actually really pile the flax in because I try to bump up her fat pretty high, and she'll eat it pretty well. So it might be worth trying because it is really high in fat, and it seems to be a little more palatable than the oil.
Yeah.
The horses love fresh ground flaxseed. I mean, they will eat it. I throw it in their beet pulp. I throw it in anything, and they'll just lick it up. They love the flaxseed, but, of course, you have to grind it. Fresh,
yeah.
Or it loses the nutrients.
Where do you get flaxseed ever?
Feed store. I went
Our
to
feed
the store and got
it,
a 50-pound bag.
Huh.
Yep.
And then just get a little coffee grinder.
Yep.
A little what kind of grinder?
A coffee grinder, coffee bean grinder.
Okay.
I just lost my coffee grinder.
Yep. I have a plan for this.
Gourmet flaxseed.
Okay.
Okay.
Very fascinating. Okay. Anything else from anybody else? Well, I want to thank everybody for being on the call, and John and Meg especially for...
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's been
a lot of
fun.
Very insightful.
Babbling.
Hope to talk with you soon.
We'll see everybody at GOSI, right?
Yeah. Yep. We'll see you all there.
Okay.
Take care.
Have a good holiday. Thank you.
Happy holidays, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.